You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of May 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, one of the key figures in Northern Ireland's peace process is arrested over his involvement in the murder of a mother of 10 in 1972. We'll assess what the arrest of Gerry Adams means for the fragile peace in the country.
Mr. Adams has been involved in a number of difficult stories over the last 2 years. This is really the first time a Northern Ireland story has really broken out of Northern Ireland, and all the newspapers in the Republic are writing about it.
I'll be joined by Robert Fox, defence editor of London's Evening Standard newspaper, and Alessio Patilano of the Department of War Studies at King's College here in London to discuss that and many more of the major stories from around the world today. Also ahead... With the World Cup in Brazil fast approaching, we'll speak to the filmmakers who have chronicled the national football team of American Samoa, described as the worst football team in the world.
Some of the themes that run through the film are about inclusion, about religion, about spirit, about togetherness of family, and not just the typical locker room story that you might see in other sporting documentaries.
All that, plus we'll check in with our Rio de Janeiro correspondent, have a review of the latest book releases. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So lots coming up here in the next hour on Midori House. But before any of that, here's David Spencer with the latest news.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. Pro-Russian protesters have stormed the prosecutor's office in the Ukrainian city of Donetsk as the situation in the east of the country edges closer to civil war. The group accused staff of working for the Western-backed government in Kiev, which came to power in February when the previous Moscow-backed president was toppled after months of street protests. Rebels in Donetsk have declared a People's Republic of Donetsk and called a referendum on secession for May the 11th. Earlier, Russian President Vladimir Putin demanded the withdrawal of Ukrainian military units from the southeast of the country. Turkish police have fired tear gas, water cannon and rubber pellets to try to stop thousands of people from defying a ban on May Day rallies and reaching Istanbul's central Taksim Square. Some groups armed with firebombs and fireworks have tried to break through barriers. Similar protests were mounted in the capital, Ankara. Monocle's Joseph Dana is in Istanbul and said authorities shut parts of the city's public transport system and deployed thousands of riot police.
The reaction of the police forces, again, has been very, very swift, and it started as early as 7 o'clock this morning. And so it seems very, very clear from the government side that they are not going to tolerate any sort of funny business, and that this ban on anyone reaching Taksim Square will stay in effect basically at all costs.
The arrest of a senior Northern Ireland politician has been described as a deliberate attempt to undermine the peace process in the region. Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams was detained as part of an investigation into one of the province's most controversial murders, a move that sent political shockwaves through Belfast and Dublin. Northern Ireland's Deputy First Minister Martin McGuinness, also a member of Sinn Féin, said parts of the police service of Northern Ireland have dark forces that are vehemently hostile to the peace process. Adams was a spokesman for the IRA in the 1980s, but reinvented himself as a peacemaker and then as a populist opposition politician. He denies the allegations against him.
Having made it clear that I was available to meet with him on this issue, there has been a long-standing and very malicious campaign against me, totally and absolutely untrue. So let's focus in on that, and let's see what we can do about all of these issues, not just this one particular issue, but all of these issues.
And we'll have more on this story shortly on Midori House. Malaysia has released a preliminary report on missing flight MH370, recommending that the UN body overseeing global aviation consider introducing a system for tracking commercial aircraft in real time. The search for the Malaysian airliner is already the biggest in aviation history. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott says the search has entered a new phase, which could take 6 to 8 months to complete. The plane had 239 passengers and crew on board when it disappeared during a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing on May the 8th. Shortly before the report was issued, Malaysia Airlines urged families of missing passengers to return home, where they would be updated with any fresh information. Many have remained in Kuala Lumpur. Two workers have been killed in an explosion at a Texas oil field. It happened in a small town close to the New Mexico border. Workers were changing a wellhead when a severe increase in pressure caused the explosion. Nine staff were also injured. Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki says the high turnout in the country's parliamentary elections are a slap in the face for terrorism. He said Wednesday's poll had defied militants trying to undermine the country's stability. The election is the first in Iraq since the withdrawal of American forces. Maliki is seeking a third term in office and is expected to win the most seats in the 328-member parliament, but fall short of a majority. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David. And David's, of course, going to be back in about 25 minutes with a run-through and an update of those headlines. You're listening to Maria House, though, at the moment. They're on Monocle 24, and we're right back after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, this is Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London. London,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is 18.06, which means it's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the day's news here in the studio is Robert Fox, defence editor of London's Evening Standard newspaper, and also Alessio Patilano of the Department of War Studies at King's College here in London. Welcome back to the programme, gentlemen. Now, we're going to start the programme in Northern Ireland. Gerry Adams, leader of the Republican Sinn Féin Party, was arrested on Wednesday evening over alleged links to the disappearance and murder of Jean McConville, a mother of 10 whose death has long been one of the defining cases of the Troubles. Well, before we get reaction from Robert and Alessio, a short while ago, the Northern Irish journalist Mike Fealty gave us this assessment of the latest news.
The origins of the story go back to 1972 and the abduction of a widow and mother of 10, Jean McConville. The controversy around the story arises from the IRA's denial of any involvement in the abduction and murder and the disappearance of the body thereafter. Gerry Adams is the leader of Sinn Féin in the Irish Parliament in the South, an MP at Westminster, the leader of the party in the North. He's also always denied any involvement with the IRA. All the newspapers have picked it up. This is really the first time that a Northern Ireland story has really broken out of Northern Ireland. That shows you just how seriously press are taking this story. The IRA was responsible for some 2,000 deaths during the Troubles. Many of those don't have prosecutions. And they would also submit that the state itself has never been substantially brought to book for things like Bloody Sunday and various other incidents like the Ballymurphy massacre, where British soldiers were involved in killing civilians. With the Haas agreement, there has been no agreement about how to deal with all of that. In the absence of that, I think prosecutions like this are going to become increasingly difficult to control as families who want some justice seek their own path.
That was Mike Fealty of the Slugger O'Toole political blog speaking to us a little while ago. Robert, this case was always a very important case in Northern Ireland, I think especially because Jean McConville was snatched in front of her children and then the body was buried and there was no closure for the family for a very, very long time. But looking at the issue of Gerry Adams, what do you make of his arrest?
I think it's very serious, and I think we're only beginning to come to terms with really the full impact of this, because the accusation is very grave, and it is, as we just heard, that there seems to be limited closure, or every time you look at closure and you get people coming in from abroad, particularly from the US, Senate, where they've been incredibly helpful, that the door goes open again. Briefly, that there are some very important points about the Jean McConville murder or disappearance. Well, it's now clearly a murder because a body turned up 2 or 3 years ago because sand shifted in an area on County Louth, and there were poor Jean's remains. It was very interesting hearing Baroness Lone, who was the ombudswoman for Northern Ireland, speaking about this, and she said this case really does have to be examined. She's been on the radio this afternoon. The point about Jean McConville is that she was a widow in a hardline Catholic nationalist area called the Divis Flats. It was really the grimmest year in terms of bombing and shooting, 1972. What was unusual about Jean was that she was by origins a Protestant. She had converted to marry her husband. Her husband had died. That is no good. It is part of the tribal nature of Northern Ireland. She was seen passing a courtesy to a patrolling soldier in the Divis Flats, where there was an observation post. By the way, the distant Irishman of the IRPS, I remember, because I was working for the BBC at this time throughout in these areas. The IRPS turned it over, and of course the Divis Flats was known as the planet of the Earps, inevitably. But to get back to the point about Mr. Adams, this is the real difficulty. And I remember going to one grinding news conference after another, and it would go on and on and on. And Jerry would stand up and say, well, that's a question for the IRA, and I have nothing to do with the IRA. And I think in a way, this was a sophistry. I won't say it was a fiction, that the Army Council, the IRA, was something completely different from the direction of Sinn Féin. In these kind of movements, it never has been so. And I think that this is going to be tested. And by the way, I think they're in much bigger trouble. They're beginning to realise, Martin McGuinness knows this, what's going to happen now. Whether there's a criminal prosecution or not, and I think your reporter was right in saying it might prove to be very difficult, I do think there's going to be a very serious civil action. And we've had that over the Irma bomb. But the template for this, by the way, is O.J. Simpson. Because what might happen is it seems that the McConville family, with many, many of those 2,000 murdered or disappeared, are now going to put a class action in. They've got the money, they've got the support, and it's going to be very, very difficult for Sinn Féin indeed, because they were all, the historic people, were all mixed up in this in one way and another. So when Martin McGuinness says today, oh, this is a political move with political consequences, he is at least 60% right, because elections are coming up. I think it's terribly difficult. They've said, why didn't we have a truth commission like South Africa? That would have solved everything. I'm sorry, just as a footnote, every truth commission is political in content because the end, the outcome sought, is political.
Alessio, what's interesting is, you know, obviously this has happened because of information that was given to a research project at a university in the United States, which was meant to be under lock and key forever and then was revealed. And what's also interesting is, if we just look back 2 or 3 weeks ago, we saw Martin McGuinness shaking the hand of the Queen. It was meant to be the sign that actually the troubles of the past were over, that we'd kind of forgiven and kind of forgotten as well. But this case shows that actually maybe people here in London and Westminster are kind of, even within the royal family, are happy to move on. But actually, back on the streets of Northern Ireland, there are still many people who need some kind of closure. And for Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams, these are going to be difficult times.
Well, you know, the role of history and the legacy of history here is central to understand what is happening, in the sense that I find, you know, at the heart of this story, there is this idea that everything revolves around how there's certain phenomena that you cannot control, or you can only partially control. And that is how, you know, as you were saying, easily you tend to forget things. But the problem is, not everybody forgets. And then when they start feeling like they've been sort of setting aside, people start looking into it in a more systematic fashion. So the historical examination process starts, and all of a sudden you find yourself in the middle of a storm that is generated by an amount of material that has been gathered over time. And people are coming out and say, like, look, you know, the story actually is slightly more complicated than what we thought. And all of a sudden, what you thought at the beginning that was some sort of a forgotten item, actually it isn't, because it speaks straight to the emotional level of those who are still there. I think what was interesting in all the reporting about the story today was how they were interviewing the children who basically were saying, you know, for us, this isn't something that is finished, because today our mum would be like 80 years old, it would be part of a story, part of our daily life. And I think what is capturing is the essence of a country that was very eager to move on and find a better sort of solution for itself, but also all of a sudden it all came back.
I'll bring you back in here, Robert. Just on that question, you know, that balance between, you know, justice and peace, which is more important?
It's not easy to do, and least of all in countries like Ireland, because Alessio is absolutely right, because the folk memory is so strong in Ireland, and this is the problem. You know, you go back to the War of Independence, the Irish Civil War, and it regurgitates all the time, and this is what's going on here. Jean McConville is blessed by the fact that she has a very articulate son leading the party, where I think the Boston project, if we can call it that, was extremely naive. Boston is a very Irish city. To think that this could be kept under wraps, that Brendan Hughes, ex-IRA leader, fell out with Gerry Adams, says to a tape recording, Gerry was in charge when this happened, that would be kept under lock and key until everybody has passed on. No, we are in a big information world, and I think it's bound to go around.
Quickly, Alessio, we're going to move on
very
in a
quickly,
second.
I mean, this is the thing that I find very naive and sort of strange in a way. How can you possibly organise an oral history project and assume that something so important is going to be recorded and nobody will want to know about it? And above all, you keep it away. I mean, the whole point of an oral history project is actually to give history a voice. So, you know, I thought this was really strange. How can you possibly think that this is not going to come back and bite you?
Well, it certainly has come back and bitten them. We're going to stay in the US now, and a case that has reignited the debate over how the death penalty is implemented in the states that continue to use it. Clayton Lockett, who was convicted of murdering a 19-year-old woman in 1999, was administered a lethal cocktail of drugs at the Oklahoma State Penitentiary on Tuesday night. Witnesses say that he writhed and groaned for 43 minutes before prison authorities have claimed he died of a massive heart attack. The White House has stated its concern today, as have many others. Alessio, when we look at this case, it seems, of course, grim and terrible. Do you think it would be the beginning of a conversation in the United States that more states will actually say, this is time for us to stop the death penalty?
I was thinking about it as I was reading the coverage in the news, and I must admit that the reactions seem to be pretty much divided in this respect, because you could easily categorize the way this piece of news was being sort of covered in two ways. Those who were focusing on the type of drugs that you use into this type of proceedings, so the mechanics of the execution of death penalty, but and this was the majority of the coverage, and a very sort of small portion of it was sort of engaging with the bigger issue here, that is whether death penalty is a solution at all. And I must admit that if this first trend, the one that focuses more on the mechanics, is going to take over the next few months and weeks as we see the situation unfolding, this debate, you know, might be sort of brushed back under the carpet. The one about death penalty. And it remains still a very controversial issue to debate in the United States.
Robert, you know, we've seen that what's happened is that the drug companies in the US upset what's happening to their share prices when they see their drugs being used in these cases and said, OK, you can't use our drugs. European companies said, look, we don't want to be a part of this. So we have these kind of homemade cocktails being made. When you look at America from the outside, this is the kind of thing that would happen in some kind of dismal starn, isn't it? It just feels so wrong for America. The White House has, you know, expressed its concern. It must be furious.
I wish President Obama, and I do hope he goes there, was on the Supreme Court, because he is very good on things like this. Mm. I only caught up with this late because I had been in Italia in the south. But joking aside, there is no joking about this. I was horrified when I read cold an account of this execution, as you say, a homemade cocktail. The governor does not come out of it at all well. She says, oh, gosh, I'd better discover something more about how we lethalize the injections more, which is not the point. This was a grossly cruel act. And it makes me proud to be a Brit. And it actually shows that there is something, at least in public, which divides Britain from America, and it is our attitude to justice. Reading the accounts today, as I was, that justice in America is still so much attached to vengeance. Mm. Justice in Britain is actually the blind figure on the top of the Central Criminal Court and balancing the scales. People do try to find justice, equity, and mercy. This is the thing. The very good commentary in the States, which you always get, top of the range, is absolutely appalled at this. And indeed, I must say that seven states came out and said, look, hold it, we've really got to think about this. And once again, in the swing states, the death penalty is off the books. But the reaction of, oh, oops, something went wrong, is absolutely unacceptable. And it's very good that President Obama came out with it straight away. I know it's state justice and I know it's not part of the federal government's business necessarily, but it was an appalling miscarriage of humanity.
Yes. Well, gentlemen, we're going to have to leave you there because there's still quite a few more stories to fit in this first half hour of the show. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Robert Fox and Alessio Patilano. We're going to return to assess another day of turmoil in Ukraine after this.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Robert Fox and Alessio Patilano. Now, Ukraine's acting president, Oleksandr Turchynov, has said that Kiev's control of the east of the country has effectively been lost. His statement comes as new unconfirmed reports suggest that Russia's military build-up on the borders of the country is continuing apace. Robert, from a defence perspective, what do you make of the latest reports?
Well, I'm afraid Mr. Turchynov was just telling us what our television screens are telling us all the time. I mean, nobody's in charge of that particular asylum out there. But funnily enough, my wife said something which I thought was quite extraordinarily intelligent from a military point of view. She said, these people are taking over police stations and the like. What do they think they're going to do with them then? Because the one thing the insurgents so far do not show any capacity to do is to patrol or roadblock beyond a few blocks of where they are. And we do know from excellent reporting all round that in between these dots, these ink spots, are where you get Russian nationalist insurgent sentiment and people saying we want to be on our own, we want to be respected and we want Russia to look after us. There are people who are indifferent to even mildly opposed. They want to live in a civil society, a civic society, and continue their living. It's very interesting that very often the news story is predicated with the role of the 40,000 plus or minus Russian troops patrolling up and down the border. As I've said before, and I think it's a running story on Midori House, and rightly so, I don't think those troops can do much. Because those troops will know, particularly if they're armoured columns, if they come in with their kit, think of Grozny 95, think of actually what a mess Georgia was, where the Russian forces didn't do so well. Well, that's only, it's more Alessio's expertise, but that's only 6 years ago. Gosh, they've improved out of sight. I think Putin has overplayed his rhetorical hand because what he has led these insurgents or insurgent sentiment to believe is that not only will the Russian flag fly, but Russia will run the whole system, the whole 30% to 40% of Ukraine. In that case, we are in a Cold War again.
And Alessio, it does look like, you know, Russia's got the bit it wants, Crimea, and it doesn't really want to kind of end up with all these actually kind of rundown, poor, impoverished towns.
Rust Belt.
Yeah, exactly. What would it do with them? So do you feel that there's going to be a kind of day of reckoning not too far off when all these poor kind of people are kind of declaring kind of their little republics are going to find out actually they haven't got the kind of backing they anticipated.
Absolutely. I think that we have to make a distinction between the majority of these regions in eastern part of Ukraine and Crimea and Sevastopol. You know, this is Crimea, Sevastopol is something that is defining. This is like Trafalgar. This is like Waterloo, you know, to the Russian people. You know, a million Russians died in the Crimean War around Sevastopol. So you can't just pretend from someone like Putin in particular, of all people, just turn around and say, you know, guys, yeah, it doesn't matter, you know, give it to them. That's not going to happen because of the symbolic, defining cultural artifact that revolves around Crimea and Sevastopol. That being said, I think the real problem here, and the point you were making earlier on is absolutely right, you start seeing there is a lack of a follow-up plan. In the sense that all these pro-Russian forces certainly have the capabilities to deprive the government in Kiev to retain the political control of the different regions. But can they just operate these regions? Because you can't just permanently stay into this sort of limbo where nobody's in control and everybody is questioning each other's control. You have then to start implementing something. And the thing here, this is the real problem, that there's no sign coming out of Moscow where you get a sense that there is actually a viable plan where a combination of the current forces with whatever local support they might have will turn the table around and say, well, this is a proper functioning region that wants to be connected to Russia. At the moment, there doesn't seem to be like that. And I think what the Ukraine government is doing very sort of smartly, partly because of the limitations that they have in their own manpower capabilities, is just to wait long enough and reassure their own people until the limitations of the current plans in Moscow will be exposed.
Now, something that used to be big in Moscow was May Day. I'm not so sure it is at the moment, but we're going to jump around the world now to see what May Day means today. And we asked our correspondents in Istanbul and Moscow, actually, to give us an update of what it means in their countries.
As expected, the police, which number up to 40,000 in the city, have effectively shut down central Istanbul. There's been a number of clashes in the kind of vicinity of Taksim Square, in some of the neighborhoods leading to the square, in which protesters have tried to rally and tried to create barricades, and the security forces have reacted with tear gas, in some cases rubber bullets, and mass arrests. And so the city right now is really full of tension. It's kind of amazing that a city of 15 million people is effectively boarded up in its very core.
The May Day parade, long kind of popular among Russia's diehard communists, usually a bunch of older pensioners and the like, this year has returned to Red Square, and I think it's symbolic of a resurrection of a kind of national or state ideology in the wake of the Ukrainian crisis, the annexation of Crimea, and now this sort of battle or proxy battle for eastern Ukraine.
Well, that was Joshua Yaffa, Monocle's Moscow correspondent. And before that, you heard Joseph Dana, our correspondent in Istanbul, talking about May Day. And let's say, what does it mean to us today, this day? It used to be the workers' day, the day to come out and demonstrate. It seems to be a day of action still for some cities. Why is it still important, do you think?
Well, I think because it speaks very much to the fundamental idea that you have the right to question an established sense of authority, and you have the right to engage into sort of a check and balances system with whatever sort of institution that you are part of, whether it is your company, whether it is public service, whether it is state. This is a voice that comes from the bottom and goes up and speaks to the sort of established sense of authority. So in this respect, it speaks to one of the very fundamental core elements of human nature, this relationship between the sort of like the grassroots level and the higher institutions that tend to be most of the time sort of, they have to be reminded from time to time that they're there to serve, not to be served.
And Robert, what's interesting is, you know, here in the UK, we had a run for a few years of kind of anarchists taking over the street, heading to the city. I think now the loudest noise is probably Nigel Farage buying a pint. What's happened to May Day here?
Nigel Farage buying a garage. Yeah. I was just thinking of that because Alessio is absolutely right. It's labour. It's the toiling masses. UK and US don't do it so well because the US sees anything vaguely pink, even an umbrella, and it's a socialist conspiracy. But here it's very different because And I think looking at May Day is very interesting because it breathes ideology, and ideology isn't around too much. And the left still isn't sorted out, because does socialism in Britain owe more to Methodism than to Marx? As was said, there is that. It's very strong. I was in Alessio's country yesterday in Barletta, a beautiful place in Puglia, and they were getting terribly excited about May Day because it was going to be the parade of the Madonna. But there was already in the square a little thing which took me back to my youth as a reporter and as a student. There was a Garofano, a left-wing rally. You know, remember we used to go to these Festa dell'Unità. I think that that is a really very important part of it. But the serious side is what happened in Istanbul. And Erdogan is reading this completely wrong, because people write about the psychology of crowds. That man does not understand the politics of crowds, and the crowds are really changing something. Back to Italy again, though, I am fascinated how ideology is coming very quietly, but in a very Anglo-Saxon way, back into the debate. And good for it, because there's, I was about to use a very rude word, but there is something all ideology in the political debate in UK, and I regret it.
Well, gents, we're going to have to pick up that conversation on another day, but thank you for being my toiling masses today. That was Robert Fox and Alessio Pasolano. Thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House.
Thank you.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, we've got plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll hear from the filmmakers who met the American Samoan national football team, reportedly the worst in the world, and we'll be in Brazil, which is marking 20 years since the death of Formula One racing driver Ayrton Senna.
It's hard to imagine that it's been so long for many Brazilians, because he still remains a very vivid character, a hero, if you will, in very many people's minds.
But before we get started on any of that, here's David Spencer with the world news headlines.
Thank you very much indeed. Pro-Russian protesters have stormed the prosecutor's office in the Ukrainian city of Donetsk as the situation in the east of Ukraine edges closer to civil war. Earlier, Russian President Vladimir Putin demanded the withdrawal of Ukrainian military units from the southeast of the country. Clashes between police and protesters have broken out in Istanbul and Turkey's capital Ankara. Thousands of people stormed. Some armed with firebombs and fireworks had defied a ban on May Day rallies. Turkish police fired tear gas, water cannon and rubber pellets to disperse the protesters. Authorities in Malaysia have released a preliminary report on the missing airliner, a document dated from April the 9th but only just made public. The report reveals details about how the plane was tracked by military radar and frantic attempts to make contact once it vanished. US Secretary of State John Kerry says he would pause and reassess what might be possible after failing to meet his April the 29th goal for an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal. Talks stalled last week after an agreement between rival Palestinian groups Fatah and Hamas. A number of Greenpeace activists have been arrested after trying to block the world's first shipment of Arctic oil from docking in Rotterdam. Dutch police made sure the Russian tanker gained access to unload its cargo. In Canada, Toronto Mayor Rob Ford has informed city staff he is taking a leave of absence, but has not said when he plans to return. The move comes a day after Ford said he'll seek professional help for a drinking problem. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, we head to Brazil and our Rio de Janeiro correspondent, Sheena Roster, who joins me now. Sheena, let's start with Ayrton Senna, obviously the Formula One racing driver. 20 years since his death, how is that being marked in Brazil?
Hi there. Yes, today is actually quite a big day in very many ways. It's actually Labor Day here in Brazil, so everybody is off work. And also, as you mentioned, it is definitely symbolic that Ayrton Senna's death has been 20 years. It's hard to imagine that it's been so long for many Brazilians because he still remains a very vivid character, a hero, if you will, in very many people's minds. He was a three-time champion for the Formula One. And basically, the reason why he became so important in the world of sport for Brazilians is because it was a time when Brazilians weren't playing so well on the football pitch, which of course is what Brazilians are typically known for. So of course, various tributes have been held for him all over the world, including in Italy, where he crashed and did die today, and also throughout the UK. Here in Brazil, there's been a lot of local media running stories about the tribute or old interviews of him. Azul, a local low-cost air carrier, even paid a tribute to him by painting the nose of one of their planes in the colors of his helmet. Yesterday in Manaus, the Amazon city that will be hosting the World Cup, the Corinthians team, they basically took to the pitch wearing helmets that resembled his. So he still definitely has also a very big influence on Brazilian society in many ways. He did start the Ayrton Senna Institute just before he died because, being a devout Catholic that he was really saddened by poverty that exists here in Brazil. So that institute is still up and running to this day, still doing a lot of social work. It's run by his sister Vivian and his nephew Bruno, who is also a race car driver. So in many ways, he is still definitely very much alive and is still definitely an important part of Brazilian history and in Brazilian popular culture, and he's definitely everybody is thinking about him today and what happened 20 years ago.
And Sheena, as you say, it coincides with Labor Day, with May the 1st celebrations. What form do those take in Brazil?
Well, because we are inching ever so close here to the World Cup, there is expected to be protests throughout Brazil today in various cities because it is a holiday and people are off work and taking their leisure time as they normally should be doing. But it's definitely, with the focus turning to Brazil with the World Cup, there are expected to be protests later on today. It's hard to say to what capacity and how well that they will develop, but there are expected to be protests and they've already been announced throughout the popular social networking platform Facebook.
Well, as you say, it's not long now till the World Cup. And although we are seeing these protests, it does seem that there's one sign that perhaps people are actually more interested in the football than they're letting on.
Oh, yes. Brazilians definitely are getting excited. And they are getting excited in one sense that that has been a really obvious sign. Basically, there has been a spike in big screen TVs for the World Cup. So people who can't afford to go to the Maracanã here in Rio or other football stadiums throughout the country, even bar owners, everybody is kind of investing. So here's just some facts for you. Over 4 million reais, that's about 1.79 billion, or sorry, million U.S. dollars that people are spending on these TVs. That's a 30% increase from this time last year, and some stores are even saying that it's a 50% increase from this time last year. The most popular model is being the 51-inch model that's selling for about 2,000 reais, and that's not exactly cheap. That's 900 US dollars, and considering that Brazilians, the minimum wage here is just over 700 reais, 2,000 reais is quite expensive. But of course, people have the option of paying in installments where they can take this out over 10 times and things like that. And some people are actually also deciding to split and go halfers on buying these TVs because people are really keen to see Brazil play. Some people, of course, are cheering even harder because some stores like Casas Bahia's, they're basically saying that if Brazil does win the World Cup, these TVs will be free.
So it does seem that, you know, there's a bit of excitement there happening on the ground. And another big event that's happening, which is kicking off now, is the start of Gay Pride in Sao Paulo. Now, I think if people don't know about this, it's actually an extraordinary event because just the numbers of people who head to the city and how the city has kind of got behind the event.
Oh, definitely. The Gay Pride Parade is kicking off today, and 90% of the accommodation that's in central Sao Paulo is actually booked just for the event. It's actually reported that this is one of the biggest Gay Pride Parades, if not the biggest, in the world. And it is a very colorful event where various people take to the streets, and it's just, it's definitely a great time for everybody who's involved in that, and it definitely brings in a lot of investment and tourism to the city.
Sheena, great to speak to you as always. That was Sheena Roster, who's our woman in Rio de Janeiro, and she's going to be helping us a lot with our coverage of the World Cup. And thanks to her, as ever, for joining us on the show. And there's more football coming your way in a moment, because we're going to be heading to American Samoa to find out just why they're so rubbish at football.
On the Foreign Desk this week, we look back 40 years to Portugal's Carnation Revolution.
When my wife told me that there'd been a coup in Portugal, my question was in favor or against.
Four decades since dictatorship gave way to democracy, we'll ask what the revolution means to the country today.
I think it's important to realise how dramatically impoverished the dictatorship had left Portugal, and how, relatively speaking, the quality of life changed dramatically.
And as Portugal continues to grapple with its economic crisis, how bright is the country's future?
Europe is in a very difficult position, and we should also change not only Portugal, because we can't change only Portugal. We must change Europe too.
That's Revolution Portugal, this week's edition of the Foreign Desk on Monocle 24.
Well, welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. In 2001, the tiny Pacific island of American Samoa was in the headlines of all the papers. The reason? Their football team suffered a world record 31-0 defeat to Australia. This prompted producer Christian Brody and film directors Mike Brett and Steve Jameson to look more into the subject. And they ended up there to make a documentary that at times feels like a fairy tale, with interesting characters such as the first transgender to play professional football and a Dutchman who decided to coach the team. The film has been getting rave reviews. Our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco met Christian, Mike and Steve earlier today in Midori House.
How did you come up with the idea of the documentary? Was it simply when you saw the headline that American Samoa was the worst team in the world?
Well, more specifically, I think the famous defeat that American Samoa had at the hands of Australia in 2001, when they lost 31-0, really, I think it speaks volumes to football fans everywhere. I think everybody who knows football knows about that result.
I was there when Australia beat us 30-0. 30 or 31, I'm not sure, but I know it was 30.
Even if you don't know anything about football, you know that 31-0 is a bad score. And I think all of us had heard about this, and it really struck a chord with me, especially because I think the astonishing thing about losing that much is it shows so much spirit to continue with the game. I think they were losing 16-0 at half-time to Australia, but you still come out for the second half. And as a contrast to some of the very rich, very well-paid players who play in the Premier League and some of the European leagues who sometimes can't be bothered to train or, you know, misbehave off the field, I think spoke volumes about the players' spirit and their love of the game and the fact that they're doing this. You know, they're never going to win. They're certainly not getting paid, but they play the game all the same. And I was speaking to a lot of people about it. I was very interested as soon as I heard more about the island of American Samoa. The more interested I was in perhaps trying to tell a story around that result. And I met Mike and Steve about 3 or 4 years ago now, and both of them were equally interested in the idea as fellow football fans as well. And together we kind of thought, why not? Let's do it. Let's go out there and see what that story will be.
I have to say that the film is not a conventional football film. It feels like a fairy tale somehow. Don't you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, whilst it is a film about a football team, we never really saw it as a film about football. It's much more a film about character and and I suppose that indomitable spirit of the team and all each of their character stories and kind of the team story that flows through the film and about them trying to overcome their relentless losing streak, shall we say, is really secondary to each of their personal character stories that runs through. And some of the key themes that run through the film are about inclusion, about religion, about spirit, about togetherness, of family. And that stuff was really important to us as documentarians. We wanted to go to somewhere like American Samoa and capture a lot of the cultural aspects of the island and not just the typical locker room story that you might see in other sporting documentaries.
I mean, if you met all the players, were they ever worried about how they would be portrayed? I mean, like, as the worst football team on earth? Or did you make sure that the film was not only about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think they'd obviously been approached by people in the past. I mean, that Australia result is so famous that it was inevitable that people would knock on the door and ask if they could make a film about it. And I think that they actually were very wary about that and had rejected previous approaches. So from our point of view, it was a bit of a trust-building exercise for a while via email, via phone calls, to kind of make clear that our intentions were not there to sort of take Mickey, but to actually celebrate their love of the game. And once we got there, once we made that commitment to travel 10,000 miles on our own dollar to actually come and visit these guys, all cynicism just completely faded away instantly. The Samoans are the most hospitable people you'll ever meet in your life. And I think the first team meeting, Tevita, the CEO of the Federation, basically said to all the players, these guys have travelled around the world to be here. They clearly love football as much as you do. Handed out some American traditional dress. So we have these little Samoan kilts, these lover-lovers that we tend to break out at celebrations, and our lower shirts, and we were made to feel absolutely 100% part of the Samoan family, and to this day they refer to us as the London Samoans, which is quite a nice touch.
They do look very hospitable. I mean, when you see the film, they're also every time smiling and happy in a way.
Absolutely.
And I want to talk about another interesting character of the film, the coach, Thomas. I mean, can you tell us a little bit more, maybe, Steve?
Thomas is a character who comes in halfway through when after we've been following the team for a couple of months, and their fortunes are pretty poor at that time. They've lost every game they've ever played there. They are bottom of FIFA's world rankings and always have been. And they're pretty mentally scarred, and they decide to reach out to the US Soccer Federation, who put out a job posting, and the only applicant is a Dutch coach called Thomas Rongen. Now, he may have been the only applicant, but he comes from pretty good football stock. He's won the MLS a couple of times as a coach. He played as a professional with players like Johan Cruyff and Franz Beckenbauer and George Best. And so, you know, he knows his stuff. And he came to the island in search of something himself, and I'm not really sure, I don't think he was really sure what that was at that stage. He was just looking for an adventure, perhaps. But he comes there as an atheist and as somebody who has experience only in the very top flight of football. So arriving to the worst football team in the world, a team that is extremely religious, as you can imagine, there was quite a lot of friction in the early days when he got there.
Go, buddy!
He's tougher.
You're playing yourself out of the starting 11 right now. If you're not going to be mentally tuned in, you're a risk, man.
When he get here, Thomas was a very difficult person to deal with.
He struggled to get on board with their cultural values, and they certainly struggled to get on board with his training regime, which was very early mornings, very late nights, eating different things, drinking different things, training physically very, very hard. And the first few sessions that he ran were quite fractious. But throughout the course of the film, something amazing happened, and it was incredible for us all to witness, and that was they as a culture managed to soften this very, very tough maverick. And at the same time, he managed to imbue, is that the right word,
I suppose? It is the right word, absolutely.
Some of his coaching soccer ethos into them and somehow turned them around as a team and brought them closer together. And that was, as a documentarian, we're very lucky.
They needed 9 goals today. You gave them only 8. It's a step. These are steps. Steps all going in the right direction.
For those who want to see Mexico wins, when is the release date? Not only in the UK, but even worldwide.
Well, we're starting out in the UK. I should say it's on general release in the US at the moment. You can go to nextgoalwinsmovie.com, which has all the information about the screenings in the US and also elsewhere. But we're opening here in the UK next Wednesday, the 7th of May. But there's also a preview tomorrow night on Friday, the 2nd of May. Is it tomorrow? Friday tomorrow? At the Clapham Picture House. And there's also a Q&A with the filmmakers, and Thomas and Jaya will also be in attendance. So
Fantastic. And just a quick question for all of you. Do you think American Samoa has a chance for the 2018 World Cup?
Undoubtedly. I mean, I'm pretty sure they'll at least reach the semis in 2018. I think we can expect them to be lifting the trophy outright by into the 2030s, I would think.
Thomas has a saying that was handed down to him by his daughter, that anything is possible. You just have to find a way to make it happen. And I think that sums up their attitudes in general. So
I agree. I can only hope. Thank you so much.
Well, that film is out now in the US and it's going to be released in the UK on the 9th of May and followed by releases in Australia, Japan and other countries. Now, you may have heard a zip being zipped, some books being plonked. Mr. Simon Prosser, who's our man who knows about books, is joining us today. He's, of course, a publisher at Penguin Books, and he's brought in a fine collection of things for us to talk through. We're having no stings. We're having no run-up to this. We're diving straight in because we want to give Mr. Prosser plenty of time to talk. Where are we going to start today, Simon?
Well, I'd like to start with the a book that's not quite out, but I think is coming out later this month. And I'm particularly interested in this because it's somewhere between a book and a magazine. It's a new book by Jeff Dyer, wonderful writer who many people will know. And it's the first in a series, really, of books called Writers in Residence. It's a project of Alain de Botton's. Really interesting project about implanting writers, embedding writers, I guess, into workplaces and getting them to write about it. So Alain himself went to Heathrow Airport and wrote a very entertaining book about a week at Heathrow. This time, Jeff Dyer, not a man you would think of being in the military service at all, really the opposite, and he spends a month aboard the USS George H.W. Bush and then writes about it. He was also accompanied by Magnum photographer Chris Steele Perkins. And the way that the book is done, it's a very entertaining book about being on life on the ship, wonderfully written as you'd expect. But I'm also particularly interested in the format. I thought you might be too.
Yeah, so what's interesting, I guess, is, you know, we think these days about all innovation around publishing happening in the kind of digital realm. But this is beautiful. And, so I guess we've had things like Granta before, which have been that kind of slight hybrid of magazine come book. Do you feel it's something in that kind of genre, kind of picking up what they've done before and running a bit further with it?
I think a lot further. I mean, it's put together by a couple of very, very talented publishers, Anna and Britt at Visual Editions. They've done, I guess, five things so far, including most recently a book that was actually a box with the pieces inside, the stories inside, printed as maps, fold-out maps. And for this one, they've approached someone called Jeremy Riley, I think is his name, who runs Mag Culture, which is best known as a blog about mags. It's very, very good. He's also a designer. And so his concept for this, I think, was very much, let's do a book that is actually in the format of, very close to Monocle, I would say, in terms of the
Jeremy oddly pops in a few times onto our show, The Stack, many years ago when I worked at Time Out in London. He was the art director there, so I've come across him a few times before. And and a really kind of interesting character. For you as a publisher, you know, when someone comes knocking at your door, and if they came to you and said, look, I'd like to do this thing that's half magazine, half book, the strange thing is that I guess publishers, they kind of see books in strict formats. They know what works when it gets to the bookshelf. They're concerned about what the bookseller thinks. It's quite a brave thing for someone to do in a way, isn't it?
I think it is. I think it's very brave and very interesting. It's sort of proposing a third way, really. And I believe it. I think the aim was to have it distributed in some places that only sell magazines alongside bookshops. So it's questioning format, really. And what's something that really interests me is what is the format for long form? Really, this is a kind of long essay, if you like, or a short book.
So it gives a credit to Alain de Botton, obviously the philosopher, and probably one of the busiest men in publishing, I would think, at the moment.
He never stops.
If he's not writing, he's talking about how you kind of get your way around an art museum. He's talking about, you know, what's happening in the media.
Yep.
So someone like that is a good influencer over the world of publishing at the moment, do you think?
I think so. And I publish Alain, indeed. And
you're going to say something nice there.
I've worked with him for 15, 16 years, I guess. And I've never ceased to be amazed by his energy, and he doesn't sleep a great deal, and he thinks a lot.
He has a foundation. He's commissioning architecture.
Yep.
He's a busy man.
A busy man.
Where should we head to next?
I think we'll head for some fiction. Maybe start with Karl Ove Knausgård. I think that's how you pronounce it.
Yeah, this is the book that everybody's kind of talking about.
Yeah,
it's one of those mighty books you see piled up in every bookshop. Is it
Is it just a big book that you think you should own, or is it a good read?
I think it's a fantastic read. This is The Boyhood Island. It's just out now. It's the third volume in a six-volume mega novel, I guess you could say. It's really one novel, but it's in six separate volumes, published originally in Scandinavia. A huge success there. The title is My Struggle, the overarching title for the book. And it, you know, caused something of a controversy because it's a, as many people might know, it's a novel about someone called Karl Ove Knausgård and his brother Yngve and his adored but rather distant mother and his feared and to some degree hated but very present father. And that's the family that we're introduced to. And we follow their story so far over the three books in translation at different times, some overlapping from slightly different perspectives, it feels. And it's an extraordinary project. It really is. And I find it riveting.
And again, for a publisher, I guess kind of reaffirming in a way that you can have somebody who can put out three mighty books and can carry the public with them, that there is an appetite for reading a huge amount of words.
I think that's right. I mean, it's not for everyone, and I have come across people who it's simply not for them. But many friends and you know, readers I trust, and a lot of writers actually that I know, think he's done something extraordinary, which is really to show that you can write. Just to give an example, there are something like 30 pages in one of the books about being 14 and trying to persuade someone to buy you beer outside an off-license or supermarket. It's not a scene you normally get in novels, and it's told beautifully in great detail. And you come to realise, well, two things happen. One is you're not bored. Actually, you're there with him. It's very much you're there with him. But there's a second thing, which is very interesting, which is makes you remember the times when you did that. And there are many, many moments in the books, particularly around childhood, where he's reclaiming things that, you know, all of us have been through, but just simply don't appear in books very often.
Simon, there's one more book in your pile for today, and what's that one?
Short and Sweet. It's sweet with a with a twist. Laurie Moore. An absolutely extraordinary writer of short stories, has a new book, newish book out called Bark. You can read it in a couple of hours. Every single story is superb.
And do we know where the title comes from, the bark?
It's a pun, I think. So it's the bark. There are three epigraphs about dogs and a couple of stories, possibly three, that relate to dogs in some way. But also I think it's about our skin, the bark around us. But fabulous writer.
And she's an American. And what's, the short story format is not something that everybody carries off successfully, you know, and we always think back of the great American short story writers and, you know, the Carvers and things of this world. What is it that she brings to you know, writing that is so great?
I think it's a really interesting modern and female twist on the sort of Carver style story, and she cuts things very differently. It's very funny, very good on relationships, and also bubbling through the books is a kind of social, political, economic background of American life. She doesn't write a great amount, but what she writes is just really bang on.
Well, Simon, three amazing books and three things that I think all our listeners will be delighted to pick up. That was Simon Prosser, who's a publisher at Penguin Books here in London. Thank you very much for joining us. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guest, Robert Fox, and also Alessio Patilano. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and also Alexandra Stenbock-Firmer. Our studio manager today, Joel Church. Coming up at 2200 hours is The Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson. And also Andrew Muller will be with you too. This show, well, it's going to be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's just time to say goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck, and thank you very much for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.